For the week of May 1st, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 101, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And riding down Fifth Avenue on a float, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you riding down Fifth Avenue on a float?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a little embarrassing, but, you know, we're recording on May 2nd, which is my birthday, and every year the city insists on throwing me a parade. You know, it's good for tourism, the kids love it, and, you know, I gotta admit, it's kind of fun.
You know, you've just ruined my joke, which was I was going to have everyone sing happy birthday to you, but then I realized, you know what? I don't think we can hear them.
That's the podcastees? No, I don't think we can hear them either.
Yes. Well, but
they'll just have to send their friends to subscribe to the show. That'll be their birthday gift to me.
Okay, yes. Get all of your friends to subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes or your RSS reader.
And if their friends join up, what will they be hearing this week?
Well, they will be hearing on today's show, Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, a staff reporter at Forbes and the author of Empire State of Mind, which is a book about the rise of Jay-Z as one of the world's top entertainment entrepreneurs. And of course, it would not be a week of entertainment news if we didn't talk about what do you think I'm going to say here?
Netflix.
Netflix, that's right. This week, however, we're going to be hearing what the head of Time Warner has to say about the company. Meanwhile, the creator of the popular series NCIS sues CBS. That's a lot of, it's like
S's.
Yeah, it's alphabet soup there. He's suing them over the show's spinoff. But is it a spinoff? We'll let you decide. Of course, we will cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, I did this jokingly last week, but I'm going to do this seriously this week. This is the world box office figures for this weekend, as best as I can determine. And I think in a year or two, we'll be doing this all the time. The number one of the movie worldwide this weekend is Fast Five, which grossed $128 million around the world in its first weekend. At number two is Thor, which grossed $83 million. It opens in the U.S. this week. And number three is Rio, the animated film. It grossed $46.1 million worldwide. It's at $366 million total. At number four is Water for Elephants, which grossed $13.8 million worldwide. Number five is Tyler Perry's Madea's Big Happy Family, which is only playing in the U.S. at $10.5 million. And number six is Hop, which grossed $8.2 million. It's at $163 million worldwide. And at number seven is Source Code at $7.1 million for a total of $83 million worldwide. Now, those are not necessarily firm numbers. I'm sure that Fast Five and Thor are the two top movies, and Rio is probably number three. There might be some film somewhere around the world in Japan or some other major market that grossed more than $13.8 million, but it's not likely. If we look at just North America now, it's kind of similar. The number one movie is Fast Five, which had a record-setting opening for this franchise of $83.6 million. It's already, as we said, at $128 million in its opening weekend worldwide, and it cost $125 million to make. This is a huge win for Universal. It's now their biggest franchise since Jurassic Park. At number two is Rio at $14.4 million. At number three is Tyler Perry's Madea at $10 million. Number four, Water for Elephants at $9 million. At number five, a very soft opening for Prom from Disney, a high school movie that only cost $8 million to make, but it's still kind of a disappointment at $5 million for the weekend. At number six was the Weinstein animated sequel Hoodwinked 2, Hood vs. Evil, also a groaner at $4.1 million on a movie that only cost $30 million to make, still a disappointment in a movie they'd kept on the shelf for quite a while, and now we know why. Number seven is Soul Surfer at $3.3 million. At number eight, the mega cheap Insidious at $2.6 million and approaching $50 million total. At number nine, Hop. And number 10, Source Code. So that's it for North America. As you can see, a lot of the same movies appear here and around the world. Movies can open overseas like Rio and be the biggest movie in the world, or they can open in the U.S. and other countries and be the biggest like Fast Five. It's just a one big happy family, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm wondering why they opened Thor in foreign territories first.
There were a couple reasons. It's holidays and scheduling, and you know, it's just a host of reasons why movies, you know, they want to get out before the soccer season begins heavily, or they want to get out after that. So there's a lot of reasons why they might want to not open a movie worldwide day and date. They fiddle with a week or two. But basically, that whole momentum of that worldwide marketing, get it out there and beat piracy and sell a big movie like that to everyone as soon as possible, it makes sense.
Right. Well, and then I think the biggest disappointment of the week is Prom, don't you think?
Well, it's not a big disappointment because it only costs $8 million to make. I'm sure they spent a decent amount of money marketing it. It's grossed $5 million. It'll be a break-even thing for them. It's not going to be a success and won't be a failure.
Well, I think when I say that it is a disappointment, it is the first film that the new Disney head, Rich Ross, put into production. And he comes from the TV side of life, the Disney Channel. And here he kind of puts out a Disney Channel-esque movie in Prom, and it doesn't really do all that well.
That's true. It stars a young actress from Friday Night Lights, a terrific TV show, which is in its final season. But he also made it for a TV price. I mean, $8 million is the cost of a pilot these days. So, you know, it's a low risk thing. It's not a big summer tentpole movie. It's not a big gamble. So, yeah, it shows him willing to make cheap movies for a price. And sometimes they'll click and sometimes they won't. And when they won't, you don't lose your shirt.
Yeah.
And how did we do this weekend compared to this weekend last year? I know you love that sort of stuff.
I know. And I know you hate it, but ticket sales were up 52% over the same weekend last year, and that's because of Fast Five, which is the biggest opening title of 2011 so far.
In the U.S.
And actually, it's in the U.S., thank you. And actually, it's the third biggest opening of all time behind Alice in Wonderland and Passion of the Christ of all time.
That's in April.
That's in April?
Yeah, that's not all time.
I thought Alice in Wonderland opened in March.
Those aren't the biggest. There have been movies that have opened 100 million, like Spider-Man 2 or whatever. So it's clearly not the record.
I think they're talking about three-day grosses.
All right. Hold on 1 second, please.
Well, I'll have to go back and see. I think it was in the Hollywood Reporter.
Well, okay. I found it. Well, there are a lot of movies over that amount. There's about 17 films that have grossed more than $100 million in a three-day weekend, like The Dark Knight, Spider-Man 3, Twilight Saga New Moon, two of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, Transformers, Toy Story 3, two of the Spider-Man, Iron Man 1 and 2. So I'm not sure what the Hollywood Reporter was. Maybe it's a spring release, something like that.
I don't know. I'll have to go back and check. Maybe they've updated it. Who knows?
Yeah, I think maybe it's a spring release because when I look at these movies, they're all summer. The only one I see in the spring is Alice in Wonderland. So maybe it's first quarter records or something like that.
Who knows?
You're right, though. Alice in Wonderland opened in March, so it's not an April record that they're talking about. But we know Passion of the Christ opened in April because that was right around Easter.
Right. Now, it's April, or no longer April, actually. It's May, which means Cannes is coming up any day now.
That's right.
And so we're both headed to Cannes, and actually, I will be arriving on Tuesday of next week. When do you arrive?
I arrive Monday night.
Monday night. So we probably will not be recording on Monday of next week. We may not even be recording on Tuesday of next week. But we will try to put something together since Michael and I will actually be in the same place. Now, on your way to Cannes in the south of France, where will you be going first?
Well, my sister lives in London, so I'll be at her apartment off Berkeley Square and probably pop across the park to say hi to William and Kate and wish them, you know, happy wedding.
Was your sister at the wedding? Did she go to the wedding?
Yes, she was one of the ring bearers.
And did she wear one of those hats that apparently you have to staple to your head?
No, there are some very gigantic. She's a big hat person, I will tell you that. So she likes being in England very much. My mother went over just to be near all the hoopla because she loves the royals. She's a huge Anglophile, though she was born in Canada. So they were in the apartment watching it on television. They ventured out a little bit into the crowds on the street, but basically they were just in England for the whole atmosphere. So my mom had a great time, and my sister did not, of course, go to the wedding, but there you are.
Well, the whole thing happened while I was asleep.
Well, I wasn't because my mother called me and woke me up.
Oh, okay. Well,
are you watching the wedding? Yes, yes, I'm watching the wedding.
Now, what did you think of the whole event?
I taped it and watched about 40 minutes in the middle with people arriving. I thought her dress looked lovely. I thought it was handled nicely and had a nice modern, just like what Diana did as far as modernizing the royal family. They did a little bit further. I mean, they might have turned around and taken an iPhone photo of the crowd in the church. That might have been even more modern. They didn't Twitter during the ceremony. But I thought it had a nice simplicity and a modern feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of interesting. If you go back to, you know, when Princess Diana was married, that was 30 years ago. And there was no such thing as HD television or widescreen formats, except in theatrical releases. And now you have this event, the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton, being streamed live onto the internet.
Oh, all over the world. I mean, Rupert Murdoch wanted to broadcast it in 3D on one channel, but they ixnayed that. Did you try to watch a stream of the show?
I did not. Well, no, I was asleep. But Livestream reported a concurrent 330,000 simultaneous streams, which I guess concurrent and simultaneous is the same thing. But
oh, you mean 330,000 different places streamed it out to the world. Is that what that means?
No, that means there were 330,000 people watching.
Well, who cares? That sounds not like nothing.
Yeah, try streaming to 330,000 individual computers live at the same time. It's very difficult, which is why 2.4 million people watched live streams elsewhere, according to Akamai, which is a content distribution network company that streams this kind of, or is the backbone for this kind of live
streaming. Most people went to like CNN or BBC. They wouldn't go to live stream to watch the wedding, would they? Is that what you mean, that live stream itself hosted it?
Live stream hosted it, CNN.com hosted it, yeah. Fox News, E! Online were among thousands of sites that did this.
Sure. I mean, it's the new way. I will say this, though, that there is something to be said for television. You know, you can go, you could be on your phone and looking at it while you're riding down the bus, and that's very cool. You could be on your iPad, perhaps, if it's possible, and watch it. But frankly, an event like this, or Obama going live on television to announce the the killing of Osama bin Laden, I was online and I was trying to get on the New York Times website, and that sucker would not download. It took 5 minutes, so I went to my TV. It's quick. It works.
Well, you know what? I think
streaming.
When did you go to the New York Times? Because they may have actually been trying to update their website, and they just may have been.
Well, it was massive traffic. I'm sure people all over the world were logging into the Times trying to download and look at the article. It's a massive amount of traffic. You know, live streaming is fun, but heck, if you're near a TV, that's better.
The last record was the World Cup. The final of the World Cup was streamed by 1.6 million, or served up 1.6 million streams. This one, at least 2.4 million streams, if not 3 million concurrent streams. That's a lot of simultaneous.
I'm not sure what, you're saying 2.4 million people were watching it on their computers?
Yes, at least.
That sounds very low.
It does sound low, but then it's a new medium as well. And that does not account for, what is it, like, in the U.S., 18.6 million households, and that's not viewers.
Well, streaming is not television. Of course not.
No. 18.6 million households were watching it on television, according to Nielsen. Which
right.
Is,
I mean, that's TV. We know doesn't count for 2.4 million people watching it online does not sound like a lot worldwide. But 23 million people watch it in the U.S., which is not nearly as big as the number of people who watched Diana's Funeral, which I think was about 34 million people.
Yes. But it was also, for the most part, in the U.S., when people were asleep.
So it's a technical challenge. I mean, that's something that, of course, they knew was coming when something like the announcement of Osama bin Laden being killed, that's something that websites can't be prepared for. They have to just know that there can be huge spikes in traffic. That's something that the New York Times and Huffington Post and AOL is constantly trying to deal with, obviously.
Yeah. Now, I mean, when I was watching the ceremony kind of on TiVo,
this is so nice to switch back and forth between the killing of Osama bin Laden and the wedding.
Yes. Well, that's why I'm trying to stick to the wedding part because, you know, it's kind of upbeat. But I was really struck by how crystal clear all of the images were, but even more so, the sound. They weren't mic'd, and yet you could hear them breathing at times.
Well, they had mics in the room. They just weren't mic'd personally.
Yes, but I mean, they did a good job of mic'ing that room. Also, I found that they really did a good job of capturing the Abbey. Have you ever been there?
Yes.
And it's kind of, you know, it's 1,100 years old, and it's very narrow and kind of dark, and they really did a good job photographically capturing all of the angles that one would want to see.
Well, I'm sure you're right that in the future we'll see even more people streaming it onto their laptop or iPad or phone. They won't feel the need to huddle by the television. They can just catch it wherever they are.
Yeah, well, and that's actually funny you should mention that, because the Time Warner CEO, Jeff Bukes, he, according to The Hollywood Reporter, kind of handed over an olive branch to Netflix and theater operators.
And how does that link to what we were talking about? Because will Netflix be streaming this sort of thing, do you think, down the road?
Well, no. I mean, I just figured it linked because you said that people would want to watch something wherever and whenever they wanted to watch it.
Oh, that's right. And then Netflix is the king of that right now.
That's right. Yeah. Well, he responded to fears about a premium video on demand and his thoughts on Netflix last week. And how many questionable claims did he make, do you think, Michael?
Quite a few, I imagine, because we're talking about it.
That's right. Now, why don't you give us a rundown? You've listed four here that I see. Why don't you tell us the questionable claims that he made?
Well, the first thing he said is that most films, this is a quote, most films have about a three-week life. And what he's saying is that after the first three weekends, a movie's dead. So who cares after that? Most of the money is made. It's time to move on. People should not be scared of video on demand. What do you think about that?
In most cases, he's correct. However, it's not about being correct on a number basis. The numbers probably back him up. At the end of the day, though, it's the sociologic, for lack of a better word, but it's more the habitual nature of human beings. And if you tell them, hey, just wait 3 weeks and you'll be able to see the movie at home, they will wait.
So you're saying even if theater owners are wrong and that the numbers don't back them up, you should take their concerns seriously anyway because they're scared?
Not that they're scared. It's that you're trying to create a market. And if you effectively kill one market by saying to your customers, hey, don't worry about this first market called hardcover, because in 3 weeks, you'll just be able to buy it cheaper in paperback. Well, then people will stop buying hardcovers because they only have to wait 3 weeks.
So you're saying no. Well, obviously, you're saying that, like everybody else, it will affect how people behave. If the more movies come quicker and quicker to video and DVD, the less likely they are to go to the theater to see a film.
Yes, thank you. Yes, actually, you've kind of somehow untwisted what I was trying to say and made sense of it. I was comparing it to hardcover and paperback books. But yes, that's absolutely correct. If you make the market for a theatrical release 3 or 4 weeks, people will just wait. The whole idea of home video is that people have to wait for it. It is a different experience and a different time.
And however, I would say he's absolutely wrong about movies making most of their money in the first 3 weekends. I mean, it can be true for certain front-loaded movies. There's no bigger front-loaded movie than the Harry Potter franchise. I mean, that's a movie everybody knows they want to see. Yes, it grossed 5/6 of its box office, almost all of its box office in the first 3 weekends. But you know what? It stayed in theaters for 5 months and grossed another $50 million after that third weekend. I mean, is $50 million not worth bending over to pick up off the ground? Do you really want to endanger $50 million? That's not peanuts, even for a film as big as, you know, Harry Potter. But look at Inception. That's another big profile movie. You know, a lot of serious interest because it's directed by Christopher Nolan and stars Leonardo DiCaprio, a huge summer blockbuster. Again, a very front-loaded movie. And you know what? It made $193 million in its first 3 weekends. But it stayed in theaters for more than 5 months and grossed another $100 million after those first 3 weekends. Those two movies are as front-loaded and big as you could ask for, really. Those are big, big franchises. Obviously, movies make a lot more money past those 3 weekends when they're smaller films or Oscar releases or platformed out or have, you know, legs. But these are big movies.
And now, did you purposefully take two Warner Brothers films?
I took two Warner Brothers. Okay. Yeah, I wanted to take his own movies and say, all right. And I picked two movies I thought would make his argument as much as possible for him. Yeah, Harry Potter grossed $900 million. So $50 million, I guess, is chump change. Unless, of course, you're a film studio and $50 million is a pretty good amount of money. And $100 million, that's a ton of money.
Well, you know, I think that what Jeff Bukes would say to that is we're taking every film on a case-by-case basis. And films like Inception and Harry Potter will not be going to premium VOD in 45 or 60 days.
But those are the examples where they make the most possible money in the first 3 weekends. Those are his best-case scenarios. And he's still leaving $150 million on the table.
I think what he's referring to is by far the film that opens on the first weekend, okay, but not great. The second weekend, it drops 50%. The third weekend, it's dropping 30%. So it's already pretty much done by the fourth weekend.
So he's only talking about movies that suck that nobody wants to see anyway. In which case, who cares? Let's move on. Number two, he says that piracy occurs during that period between the end of a movie's box office run after those first 3 weekends and the release of the DVD 4 or 5 months after a movie opens. What do you say to that?
I think that the second the first image of a film hits the very first movie screen that it's going to be projected on, you have piracy.
So what does that say about Bukes that he could be that confused about piracy? I mean, that's common knowledge. That's obvious to almost anybody who's been following the concerns of piracy over the years.
Well, I think that what he's saying is theatrically, if I don't really understand.
He's saying the danger zone is when the movie is out of the theaters or basically everyone's seen it that wants to and it hasn't come out on DVD yet. That's when people will pay for bootlegs and watch bootlegs and rent bootlegs. That's what he's saying. And I'm saying, well, okay, but since bootlegs appear the second the movie debuts, how does this change anything? He's saying, well, are we going to wean them off bootlegs by offering them a $30 chance to rent a movie for 24 hours?
No, really? You're not going to. And in fact, at some point, somebody's going to be able to crack the sock. And
yet another chance to pirate it.
Yeah, somebody will be able to hack the selective output control and they will be able to pirate it just as you said, and they'll get a pristine, clear copy a little bit sooner than they would have if you had waited to release the DVD.
But it makes no sense to me. Again, when the movie is hot and in the theaters, that seems to me a prime time for people to bootleg movies and watch them. You know, all the attention is on them. You know, 4 or 5 weeks after the movie's not hot anymore, when he claims nobody cares, why is that the really dangerous point for bootlegging? Surely it's that opening weekend and the second weekend when everyone's talking about the film. So again, he seems to have a fundamental lack of knowledge about movies and piracy and how theaters work. When he says, who cares about a movie after the first 3 weekends? I just find it shocking.
Well, it's kind of like a politician. I can say it, and therefore it is true. And if I say it enough to enough people, eventually they'll begin believing me.
This isn't necessarily controversial. I just found it sort of interesting or odd. He says that Netflix is like subscription television, meaning HBO and Showtime. Now, it's true that Netflix just announced they're going to have some original programming. They're going to fund a miniseries. But how do you think that comparison works out? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, they're a subscription service like HBO and Showtime, but they're, I don't know why he's trying to even talk about them in the same breath. He's trying to put them together somehow, and I don't know why.
I mean, they're bigger than Comcast, the biggest cable operator. So it seems like they're a big player in a much bigger universe than a single channel service like HBO. So to me, it was like saying Apple is in the music business. Well, yeah, but that's not really where they're making their money.
Actually, you know what? I understand why he's lumping them together, because much like HBO and Showtime, Netflix is coming to Warner Brothers and saying, we'd like to pay you for content. We want an output deal. Please send us your content and here's some money for it. So that's why he's really looking at it much like HBO and Showtime, because consumers pay those networks a subscription fee. The networks pay the studios a licensing fee. Same is true of Netflix.
And then he mentioned in closing, and this also is not controversial, he said that Russia is now the fifth largest movie market in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's just on fire. And this is a country where piracy was a huge problem and continues to be a huge problem.
So what happened? Was it building good theaters that got people to come to the theater? Or how did they crack this nut? How did they make this market work?
A couple of reasons. One, you're right, they did build good theaters and improve the theater-going experience. And the second thing is the economy. Of course, people started to have a little bit more money, and therefore they could go to the theater. And they have a pretty good homegrown local film industry.
That raises my question. What are the top four largest movie markets? I assume North America is number one. I think Japan is number two. Is it India, Bollywood, or what's considered the third and fourth biggest markets?
You know, I tried to look this up yesterday, and I got sidetracked. But there's Japan, there's South Korea, there's India, there's Mexico.
And obviously European countries like England, France, and Germany.
Right. And Germany's up there. France is up there. I'd have to double check. We can actually, if any of our listeners know, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and let us know.
So are people going to keep going to see movies in the theaters, or perhaps will they start turning to YouTube? I mean, forget Netflix. Maybe YouTube is the big new player.
I don't think YouTube is going to be a big player here. But what I know is studios really like the fact that they will now have a competitor to Apple and a competitor to Amazon, who is streaming them for free to Prime members, or you can do video on demand transactional. The one thing that studios really like about YouTube is that it's transaction based, not subscription based. That means every time you watch a movie, you will have to pay for it.
So on iTunes, if you go through Apple, you usually pay for a movie to rent it or to buy it. On Netflix, you pay a monthly subscription service, and that lets you stream unlimited. And the same is true, I guess, for Amazon. If you're a Prime member, you can stream whatever is available unlimited amounts of times.
Right. Well, yeah. Or you can do pay-per-view. So Apple, Amazon are both transactional-based, unless you're a Prime member, in which case for Amazon, it becomes subscription-based. It's very confusing.
I'm trying to clean it up, but there we go. Yeah. So we have YouTube thrown into the mix. What are they offering?
We're talking about this, though, as if it was announced. We're talking about it as if it's happened, but really this was an exclusive that The Wrap was reporting on that said YouTube has approached several studios, I think four, that are going to allow them to rent movies through their website. Sony Pictures, Warner Brothers, Universal, so three, Lionsgate. They are going to rent movies through YouTube, video on demand, whereas Paramount, Fox, and Disney have declined to join in. And it is the biggest deal, the biggest VOD deal, since all of these major studios signed up to Apple's iTunes rental service back in January of 2008.
And they're going to be offering movies at the same time as when they're out on DVD and iTunes, which means they'll be ahead of Netflix and Redbox, for example.
That's right. So they're going to be ahead of, well, in the case of Redbox, it's pay per viewing. And in the case of Netflix, it's subscription service. I know that the studios hate Redbox because it's only $1 to rent a film, but you know, they're really trying to find some competition for iTunes.
But I mean, there already is Netflix and Amazon.
I don't think they look at Netflix as competition for iTunes because Netflix is a subscription model. They make a licensing fee, but they don't make a per transaction fee. And they're looking for that per transaction fee.
Why is that so much better for them?
Because instead of earning cents for every viewing, you can earn dollars.
But you earn cents on so many more. You know, obviously you can have 10 million people subscribe every month as opposed to 100,000 rentals. So
yeah, but
it doesn't all work out. I mean, is the money not from Netflix not serious money? I mean, they're spending $500 million on you know, rights to movies. Clearly they've got some serious money to throw around.
Well, would you prefer to sell 200 million DVDs if you're Disney and get $2 for each DVD? Okay, that's how much, you know.
I want to get whatever makes more money. I don't understand why the model isn't necessarily going to bring them equivalent amounts of money.
Okay, well, I'm just going to do some quick math. I'm going to start with transaction-based. Let's say you have 200 million rentals or, 200 million rentals in a year for all of your titles, and you're going to earn $2 for every rental. So that's
when was the last time they had $400 million in rental fees?
Yeah, well, that's actually not uncommon. Now, take that same 200 million views, okay, and take it over to Netflix, who will pay you $125 million to license the content.
Yeah, but when you have unlimited access, you have a lot more views. The idea that I'm going to rent and I'm going to view more movies if I have an unlimited subscription than I am if I have to pay per film, obviously.
Right, but you don't earn money
you pay for fewer DVDs, you'll rent more of them, and you'll watch even more of them if it's subscription based. So you're comparing apples and oranges. I might rent two movies and watch 10 if I get to, you know, have unlimited access.
And let's say you watch 10 Warner Brothers movies. Do you know how much Warner Brothers would gain from that? In the year that the content is licensed, they would gain nothing. If the only movies that people watched on Netflix were Warner Brothers movies, they'd still make the same $125 million that in that.
They don't get any piece of the pie. It's not based on.
That's the whole point. You're licensing the content and then reselling it to your subscriber base.
Well, then they need to charge more money.
Precisely.
That's okay. It'll all work out. But I say they shouldn't care as long as they get the same amount of money. And there's no reason why they can't demand more money if Netflix is getting the equivalent of $200 million in benefit. Then ask for $200 million.
I think they're trying to figure that out.
The problem is not subscription. The problem is figuring out the right balance of what to charge who to make sure they make the same amount of money.
Right. And YouTube has yet to announce all of this officially. But I think that the reason that this speculation is out there or that this is about to occur is because of Robert Kinkle, who is YouTube's new vice president of TV and film entertainment. But he comes from Netflix. So he cut all of these same deals for Netflix. And then Netflix last week announced their first quarter earnings, and they were just off the charts.
Well, their worldwide revenue jumped 47% to $719 million. Net income increased a ton. They have 22.8 million subscribers. They added 3.3 million new customers in the U.S. and another 300,000 in Canada. So everything's just going like a house on fire.
Yeah, and when you say, you know, worldwide revenue, let's face it, it's the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're just starting to spread elsewhere, right?
And they're talking about licensing some other original programming or paying for some other original programming, but not on the level of House of Cards, which is this Kevin Spacey drama. And they characterize the deal, according to the LA Times, as an experiment. And the goal, they said, was to see if Netflix could build an audience for serialized programs. And the quote from, I guess, Netflix was, rather than shift in strategy towards original programming, our decision was driven by a desire to test a new licensing model using a small portion of our content budget.
And yet Netflix says, even though we're going into HBO territory, cable networks should not feel threatened by us.
That's right. We're not a friend. We're not an enemy. We're a friend.
But one enemy of Netflix could be DirecTV, right?
Well, DirecTV and Comcast. DirecTV is actually, they sent out a survey last week asking their subscribers whether they would like DirecTV to enter into a subscription-based over-the-top service, as these are known, over-the-top, in other words, over-the-top of the cable box or satellite box. And it would. They actually mentioned Netflix in the survey. They say it would be a lot like Netflix. Would you like that? If so, how would you like it priced and how would you like it to be?
And Comcast is expanding its services as well.
Yes, well, they're really expanding their services. They're getting all of these networks, the big three networks, big four networks. They're getting all of the shows. They'll keep the last four episodes of shows for video on demand. So if you miss a show, you can just go and view it through a VOD service for free.
So it's just like Hulu.
Yes, but
does
on your TV.
Does it include the ads that were aired originally, or are there new ads?
Actually, it's very interesting. There are new ads, and they can be better targeted and better directed. You know, they can even customize the ads to each viewer.
I'm wondering when Time Warner will offer that. And of course, Comcast, which made waves by saying they're going to have this crazy premium video on demand thing where, you know, 60 days after a movie debuts in a theater, you can pay $30 to watch it in the privacy of your own home. Now they say, actually, we're going to do it in 45 days. So this is incredibly quick. Everything is changing a lot. And the basic message is, whether you're a cable company, a subscription model like Netflix, whether you're YouTube, all these people want content. Content is still king. They all want content. They're all trying to make deals. Whether you're a satellite company like DirecTV and you're beaming into their homes, or a wired cable company or an online website, you need content, and you need to make deals to have as much content available as soon as possible to as much of your base as you can. And that's the way to win.
Yeah, I liked what the head of Comcast had to say, or the general manager of Comcast Video Services said, consumers want to get content on their own terms. They want to watch when they want and where they want. Really? Then let me take your iPad application out into the real world and stream from there. How about that?
Well, they'd love you to. Comcast is not the one keeping that from happening.
Well, good point. Yeah. And, you know, really, when you see the network cutting all these deals with Comcast and Time Warner,
it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. I mean, you have to think that if you're an O&O, an owner-operated affiliate for, say, Fox or NBC, they just do not care about you anymore.
No, you own a local TV station, you're one of those last survivors, God help you.
Yeah.
I mean, everything on your primetime network is available online from a million different sources now, from the cable company, from Hulu, from somebody else, perhaps Netflix down the road.
And your supplier that cut that exclusive deal with you is now saying, well, it's not just online that we're kind of breaking this exclusivity pact. We're going to be doing it on television as well.
And Vivo is joining in as well, right?
Well, yeah, Vivo, this is a quick story. Vivo is this record label launched music video channel. It's kind of like MTV, but online. It's launched in the US, was incredibly successful, and now it's launching in the UK.
And another announcement, this wasn't an announcement today, but I just got an email saying that HBO To Go has officially launched, and that's the app that allows you to watch HBO and their entire library of original programming, not their current like Hollywood offerings, but anything that HBO created, like Deadwood, The Sopranos, Game of Thrones, Sex in the City, all available basically any way you want, anytime you want, every episode from beginning to end.
I was actually thinking of subscribing to HBO just for HBO Go.
That's funny. I'm planning to subscribe in, I think, July for 1 month, and I will crash watch all the Treme episodes and all the Game of Thrones episodes and then cancel it. So for $15, I get to watch two seasons of both shows in like 4 weeks and catch up on some other stuff and then be done.
And now that they know that, they're not going to allow you to subscribe.
Right.
Well, you know, you said content is king, Michael. One person who creates content, Don Bellisario, he is the creator of NCIS.
I've interviewed him. He's a fun guy.
Yeah. CBS created a spinoff of NCIS called NCIS Los Angeles. And Donald Bellisario is now suing CBS because of that spinoff.
Yeah, he's the creator of a lot of hit shows, from Magnum PI and Quantum Leap to NCIS, which is a huge, huge hit now for CBS. I mean, it is their flagship show. Bellisario says it was specifically in his original contract that he must be given the first shot at creating any spinoffs and sequels to the NCIS franchise, and that CBS reneged on this when going ahead on NCIS LA. Well, what can we learn from this story? A lot, actually. First of all, in this story that I found on Deadline.com, they mentioned casually that everyone knows that writers don't own the rights to the TV shows they create. Well, I didn't know that. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. The rights are owned.
How does this happen? What is the deal?
Well, I mean, you're selling that intellectual property to a network or to a production company that wants to own the rights. They have to have all the rights so that they can exploit it, as they say, in all ancillary markets. And as a matter of fact, well, why am I forgetting his name? The guy who plays Buzz Lightyear?
Tim Allen.
Tim Allen. I can't believe I forgot his name. Tim Allen went on the road once and did this his shtick, you know, right after Home Improvement was a TV show, and Disney called him and said, "You can't do that. All of those bits are ours now. They're all part of, you know, Disney now. You can't go out on the road and make money on tour doing those bits."
Well, I understand that's for a show that's being launched or for a new talent, but once you're an established TV veteran like Stephen Bochco or whomever, surely at that point you have the clout to say, you know what, bitch, this is my show.
Well, no, it's your show and you have a share in the show and you earn a certain amount in royalties, and but you, it is the rights go back
but
to the production.
How come nobody
to
has
you.
Said, uh-uh? How, I mean, people want to make a deal with, you know, the people have lost. When they made their next show, didn't they have the prestige and clout and commercial oomph to say, by the way, this is ending for us. We're too big. I mean, I can tell Steven Spielberg he doesn't have certain rights. You know, yeah, everything's negotiable. I don't understand why that wall's never fallen. I found that very interesting.
Well, I mean, if you're the production company and you're footing the bill for production, you probably can own the rights. But most producers don't have that kind of money.
The second thing we learned was that NCIS LA, over its run, is estimated that it's going to gross $1 billion for CBS in all the many ways it can, being shown around the world, syndication, DVDs, online streaming, you name it. They think of this as a billion dollar property, I should say.
Well, you said it was a flagship show. Wouldn't CSI be the flagship show for CBS?
Not anymore. No, CSI will probably have its last season next year and move to Fridays at 9 or 10 o'clock, which is where it debuted, opposite The Fugitive. And everybody picked The Fugitive as the big hit, and CSI was the one that broke out. But it'll probably have its last season next year and be on Friday nights. The CSI franchise is a little tired. NCIS is the top ratings getter right now.
Well, could you fault people being tired of CSI when they have CSI Miami and New York and CSI everywhere?
I mean, Law and Order did it for decades. Everybody has their run. It's not that it's a, you know, it's had a long, healthy, beautiful run. But if NCIS LA is worth $1 billion, Don Belisario's claim could be worth more than $100 million to $200 million. So this is serious money we're talking about. Then another thing came out. He was kicked off the original NCIS in 2007 over a dispute with the star Mark Harmon. Did you know about this?
No, I didn't.
I knew nothing about this. It took a surprising amount of digging for me to figure out what had happened way back when. Finally, I discovered that Mark Harmon, who's generally described as a very nice, easygoing guy, was just tired of Belisario's chaotic management style. I guess it's sort of a thing like Moonlighting, where he was writing scripts at the last minute, or I don't know what the problem was, but it was enough to make him put his foot down. And he said, either I go or he goes. And Belisario went. You know, at the time he said something like, oh, I'm doing it for the good of the peace and all that. But yeah, maybe they're friends again now. I have no idea. But that's kind of interesting. That was well into the run of a little bit, and the show was a big hit by then. I imagine Harmon was renegotiating his contract or something, but it's kind of surprising that a guy with so much experience from Magnum PI on could have a working style that would freak out a star so much that he'd say, look, I'm sick of this. The funniest thing of all was the fact that CBS insists that NCIS Los Angeles is not a spinoff from NCIS.
That's really the crux. Is how could they possibly say that? I mean, they have the same name.
Keep going.
Well, they say they share not only the name, but several characters, including the head of NCIS. They inhabit the same fictional universe. CBS schedules NCIS LA right after NCIS, and actors on the latter are quoted extensively talking about the similarities between the shows. So NCIS LA replicates the style, the structure, and the approach to storytelling of the original, a la Law & Order.
Yes. I mean, the idea that legally they can argue this is not a sequel or spinoff is so laughable, it kind of boggles the mind.
I don't know what they're thinking. But overall, I mean, do you think it's a big deal that Belisario is now suing CBS?
I think it's a big whoop. I think it's probably a business decision, and they'll probably settle before it gets to court too much. And it's just one of those things that happens, and everybody will keep working together and things will be fine. You know, hey, I'm sorry I'm suing you for $100 million, but what's that between friends?
Well, I'll tell you, if CBS thinks for a second they're going to lose in public court, they most certainly will settle. But that was my segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, author Robert B. Parker is dead. Long live Robert B. Parker. Publishers love the steady sales of genre fiction featuring a popular sleuth, cop, detective, forensic expert, you name it. And you know what? Why let the death of an author bring all of this to a halt? Numerous authors seem to be passing on their franchises to their children, like fantasy author Anne McCaffrey, handing off the Dragon Riders of Pern to her son Todd. James Bond keeps having adventures, and now two major series by the best-selling author Robert B. Parker have been assigned to new authors. So you can expect more stories featuring Spencer and Jesse Stone. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I guess it's part of a trend, so it's just a big whoop. It's nothing that unusual, but it is kind of surprising how commonplace it's become and how much fans will accept it. I mean, the Bourne series keeps on going. You know, Robert Ludlum's Bourne series, written by somebody else. It's kind of amazing, but these properties are too viable, I guess, for publishers to let them die.
Paula Abdul is back. In one of the more obvious and yet somehow smart moves, Simon Cowell picked Abdul to join him on The X Factor this fall. She joins music producer L.A. Reid and British songstress Cheryl Cole. At the same time, Idol's Jennifer Lopez is working with the show's Simon Fuller to launch a Latin-style music talent search they plan to carry all over North, Central, and South America, as well as Spain, all at the same time with one big super show. That's kind of actually interesting. Are these developments a big deal or a big whoop?
I think they're a big deal. The fact, I mean, Idol is the number one show in the country, but X Factor is making news for every little bit of casting. Simon was very smart to bring Paula back. Thank God her dance show collapsed. That makes it much easier to do. And I think this, you know, pan-Latin, it's sort of like a world idol for Latin people. It's going to be seen all over the world in Latin-speaking countries. And I think it's a really fascinating idea.
Does this mean they're going to have to sing in Latin? Because I'm pretty confident that that is a dead language.
God, keep going.
That's an old Dan Quayle joke. Hey, the Sony PlayStation Network has been down since it faced a breach on April 19th, a security breach, that is, and it's still down in large part. Now it's fessing up. They were hacked, and the people who did it had access to millions of users' private information, including logins, passwords, credit card info, and even answers to security questions. That brought a harsh reprimand from Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, but Sony insists it took them days to figure out what was going on. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal because of how they handled it. Everybody has hacks and security breaches. It's almost commonplace for someone to say, oh, sorry, 20 million names and accounts were accessed accidentally. Not everything was encrypted. And the big problem is that they didn't tell people immediately. You know, they said, well, we need to figure it out. No. As soon as you find the broken lock on your door, you say, uh-oh, someone might have broken into our home. And people with credit cards should have been told right away, we've had a security breach. We're not sure what's happened. Please take reasonable precautions and we'll inform you more as soon as we know it.
Well, they did that, I would say, a couple days after. One reason they don't do that is they don't want word to spread out that, hey, their defenses are down and therefore, hey, everybody try and come and hack us. All you hackers out there, we're really vulnerable right now. They want to try and get their house in order before they...
Why would they be more vulnerable?
Well, because when you have one person trying to break into your house, that's one thing. When you have 400 people trying to break into your house... more than likely, somebody's going to break in.
See, but that's a false problem. The idea, like, well, since somebody broke in, we can't let people know because then more people try to break in. It's like people are always trying to hack into all these big companies. They're always going to be trying to. And to say someone was successful is not a reason to lie and hide to your customers the fact that their personal credit card information could be compromised.
Well, this is a bad day for Superman because he's no longer an American.
Well, only it's a bad day for America, maybe, but a great day for the world.
That's true. And I believe that's what our President Barack Obama said. That's right, the Man of Steel has renounced his U.S. citizenship in the latest storyline found in Action Comics 900. When the guy in the cape took action in Iran, the government of Tehran accused the U.S. of interfering in their internal affairs. Realizing he's always been associated with the good old USA, Superman decided something had to change and went to the UN to renounce his citizenship so he could be seen as a citizen of the world and acting on his own behalf in what he believes is in the best interest of the world, not just the United States. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I keep thinking we should have a disclaimer saying, you know, this isn't actually true. This is just part of the comic book series. But hopefully people understand that. This is a big deal. It's a somehow feels like a very significant change in the Superman mythology and a very risky one. I mean, maybe it'll make him even more appealing around the world. Maybe people will be annoyed and upset. That's unpatriotic. How dare he not? You know, he's from Krypton, obviously. But I'm really worried about Clark Kent. Does this make him an illegal immigrant?
Oh, good question. He might not actually be able to work at the Daily Planet anymore.
That's right.
The king of cool was Steve McQueen, thanks to movies like The Getaway and The Great Escape. Now actor Jeremy Renner is producing a biopic of the actor that he will also star in. Apparently, starring in half the franchises in Hollywood, like the Avengers and the Bourne films, wasn't enough for Renner. Is this new project a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. Guy gets role, or rather, guy creates role for himself. I'm not sure if a biopic about Steve McQueen is terribly interesting. I mean, he's a great movie star, and I'm not sure Jeremy Renner is good looking enough to play him. Frankly, that may be rude, but I couldn't play him. I'm not sure he's the right person for that role.
The band Bon Jovi will be riding their steel horses all over the world on their latest tour, but lead guitarist Richie Sambora won't be with them. These mega event tours have to be planned way in advance. The dates were surely nailed down in 2010. So when Sambora realized he needed to enter rehab to deal with a drinking problem, it was easier to just keep the show on the road than put it on hold and wait for him to sober up and get his act together. So that's rehab and losing out on probably tens of millions of dollars. Man, I need a drink. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's unfortunate for him, but the show will keep on going and, you know, fans will miss him, but most fans will be happy to see Bon Jovi as long as, you know, John Bon Jovi's there singing leads. I shouldn't even say that since Van Halen went ahead without, you know, with their lead, David Lee Roth. So everybody's replaceable, I guess.
Yeah, although the band wasn't called Roth Halen. It was called Van Halen, and Eddie Van Halen was still there.
That's right, dude.
The Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA are one step closer to merging. Again. The SAG board announced unanimously they should merge with AFTRA and form a task force with plans to present a full plan to both unions. So it's like planning to plan. They're also going to include an agreement, a constitution, and dues policy by January 2012. AFTRA meets May 14th and is expected to second that vote. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal, I think. We're talking about 150,000 people total. About 150,000 people total when you add both groups together and eliminate the double memberships that some people have. So that's a huge union. It's, you know, SAG is 120,000, AFTRA is 77,000. So, you know, it's like SAG growing by another 30,000 people. So they'll have a lot of clout, a lot of weight, and hopefully it'll make negotiations easier and more simplified down the road.
Well, it'll certainly give them more negotiating power, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think SAG had to do this because all the television contracts went to AFTRA.
And so many people have crossover now between film and TV that it just makes no sense that they're not represented by the same people.
Right. The Two and a Half Men reboot may skip the fall TV season and premiere new episodes in 2012. John Cryer is promised a quote-unquote major role. Was there a chance he wouldn't have a major role? Because isn't he the only one left? Sheen is still campaigning his ass off, but no one will even talk to him. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I was wrong. I thought Sheen would come back. I thought there was no reason why they shouldn't bring him back. I thought they would have a bad case in court. I thought they would just want to put it behind them. And apparently he's been more of a pain in the neck than I imagined. And it's kind of amazing. He's both campaigning and saying how much he really wants to be back on the show and trying to arrange meetings with the other actors to try and, you know, build some goodwill and get them to campaign for him. And yet on the other hand, he's on stage calling the creator of the show a schmuck and a loser and many worse names than that. So this is a big gamble for it's their number one sitcom on CBS. NCIS is their number one franchise and that creator is suing them. And Two and a Half Men is their number one sitcom and they've just kicked their star off the show. So this is a big deal for CBS.
So Charlie Sheen is meeting with John Cryer and saying, when I said troll, it wasn't really in the negative sense.
Yeah, and John Cryer is not meeting with him. That's the point.
Yeah. Pulitzer Prize winner Roger Ebert finally made it into The New Yorker, but he had to enter a contest to do it. People were amused to see one of the entrants in the magazine's weekly cartoon caption writing contest was a Roger Ebert of Chicago. Yes, that Roger Ebert. He actually won the whole Megillah, but don't think he makes it look easy. Ebert admitted he entered 107 times before finally capturing the brass ring. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, obviously. It's just a little amusing tidbit, but 107 times, I don't know whether to admire that or find it sad.
Well, I mean, you know, there is nobody I know that has the output of Roger Ebert. I mean, between his Twitter and his blog and his reviews, he's just on fire.
I've posted three things on Huffington while we were talking.
Are you serious?
No.
I was going to say, my goodness. Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop and takes us right into Inside Baseball, the weekly segment where we focus on the stories that mean the most to people in the industry and why you should care. This week, we're going to focus on the music business. Joining us now is Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, a staff writer at Forbes, where he has covered finance and music since 2005. He's also the author of the just-released book, or just-published book, I believe they say in the biz, Empire State of Mind: How Jay-Z Went from Street Corner to Corner Office. That's the name of the book. It's out now from Portfolio Penguin and available wherever books are sold and digital copies are legally downloaded. Zach, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Zach, I read your book, Empire State of Mind, and it charts the career of Jay-Z from a business perspective, which makes sense since you're a writer for Forbes. And you talk about him both as a hustler, a guy who was selling drugs on the street corners, literally, and a rapper, and ultimately as an entrepreneur. So tell us about the book and why it's so interesting that Jay-Z refused to do an interview with you.
It was kind of the way I thought that would work out. You know, I went in with my book deal and my pitch and everything to meet with his people. And I thought business focused profile of Jay-Z, putting him up in the pantheon with Warren Buffett and Steve Jobs and the like, I thought it'd be a slam dunk. But, in the end, he wanted money and he wanted control. And, that wasn't something that my publisher and I were prepared to give. But when you look at it in hindsight, I mean, at least when I was reporting the book, it kind of makes a lot of sense. That's how he does his business. He doesn't really participate in anything unless he's getting something out of it. And you could take that all the way back to the late 90s when he was rapping about a brand, clothing brand called Iceberg, and their sales shot up. He went to meet with their executives and tried to get an official endorsement deal or an equity stake, and they wouldn't give it to him. So he and his business partner, Damon Dash, started Rockaware, and the rest is history. Jay-Z sold the rights in, I think it was 2008, for $204 million. And if he had just kept rapping about Iceberg, he wouldn't have had any of that. So, that's kind of how he operates, and that's how he's gotten to where he is today.
Yeah, and even before he became a big star, when he'd signed a record deal, he was selling drugs on the street, and he had a record deal now. And for most people, that would be, oh my God, this is my shot out. I can be legitimate. I can, have a career as a rapper. And he was looking at it as a businessman and saying, well, what's most likely to bring me more money? And frankly, it's the drug dealing. I'm making money hands over fist, and the music industry is a crapshoot. And he literally was more interested in following the drug business for a little while. He was not wholly committed to being a rapper.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when he had his singles only deal, this was in the mid 90s, not with a major label or anything, just a little bit of money here and there to do, one off. I think it was with Payday Records. It wasn't a lot of money, and he was having quite a lot of success on the street, and he always knew he could rap. But I think one of the things that I kept hearing in reporting the book was it came so easy to him that he thought, how could this be, how could I be special if this comes so easy to me? And as the years went on and he did the singles only deal. And after a while he started his own record label with Damon Dash, Rockefeller Records, and then, which was eventually purchased by Def Jam, in increments. He began to see that there was really a lot more money to be made in the music business. And of course, there were other perks like not getting shot at or having to risk going to jail. So,
yeah. I mean, you write that he shot his own brother.
He did. This is something he actually admits in one of his songs, You Must Love Me. I think it was on the second album. It's confirmed by a number of people who I spoke to for the book. His brother was, struggling with drug addiction and, had become something of a kleptomaniac, at least, with Jay-Z's stuff, when Jay-Z was a teenager. And so Jay-Z's brother stole a ring that Jay-Z owned. And so in order to, as the story goes, in order to try and scare his brother, Jay-Z tried to shoot above his shoulder, but instead hit him in the shoulder. Fortunately, his brother wasn't seriously injured. But the guy whose house he ran over to immediately after shooting his brother, it was a rapper by the name of Jazzo, who was sort of his mentor in the early years, first rapper to ever get a record deal with EMI. This was in the late 80s, and this guy Jazzo, really had a lot to say about Jay-Z's early life and sort of subsequent you know, explosion into the pop culture scene.
Now, at one point, Jay-Z was the head of a record label, Def Jam in particular. He was an executive there, and he gives himself an A+ for his performance at the label. What would you give him as a record label executive?
I think A+ is maybe a little strong, but you know, but I don't think I would give him anything lower than a B+. I might give him an A-. You know, I think simply because, I mean, you know, the numbers, you know, weren't so great. I mean, you know, he was the president, I think, from 2004 to 2007, which was not, maybe it was 2005, but it was a 3-year period, and it wasn't really exactly a growth period for music, on the whole. So you can't really say that he, kind of turned Def Jam around or anything, you know, or in a super duper spectacular way. But, you know, what he did was, he brought on a lot of acts, who are really big now that a lot of people don't, sometimes remember, or acts that he was, you know, directly involved in signing. Rihanna, Neo, Rick Ross, those were all Jay-Z signings. And of course, you know, Kanye West, he really helps nurture his career as well. So, you know, I think on the artist development side, you know, I would certainly give him an A. But, you know, in terms of the business side, it's not really his fault. I mean, it was, you know, an era of declining everything in the music business, and, you know, that hasn't necessarily stopped. So, you know, I'm not sure how much better a job anybody could have done.
But a fascinating part of a lot of the book are business deals and endorsements. There's a lot of talk about vodka, Armadale vodka, and a champagne, Armand de Brignac, if I'm saying that properly. And yep. You, for a lot of reasons, go into his involvement in these brands and how what stake he had in the companies. And my questions are twofold. One is, why was he involved with two such lame brands as far as quality? That seems to be out of character with Jay-Z, since so much of what he does is supposed to be the best, whether it's the clothing or a Jeep or, you know, his music. Why, when it came to these alcohols, did he make such poor choices?
Well, you know, I think with Armadale, that was his sort of his first step. And, you know, vodka is vodka is vodka. I mean, I guess it depends who you ask, but that's kind of my opinion. I mean, there's maybe less opportunity to vary the taste in vodka than there is maybe in a wine or champagne, or even a beer. You know, I think that was kind of his first foray, into alcohol. And I think he was looking for something that, you know, is really club friendly. You know, they found a good situation that kind of went with it. But, you know, I think that the reason Armand de Brignac completely disappeared a couple of years ago wasn't because it was particularly bad, although I've never tasted it. From what I've heard, it was decent. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't fantastic. But the reason it totally disappeared was because Jay-Z stopped promoting it entirely after he and Damon Dash broke up. This was he and Damon Dash and Kareem Biggs Burke. This is the third guy who was involved in founding Rockefeller Records. They went in on Armadale Vodka. But the three of them officially parted ways right before Jay-Z took the helm at Def Jam. And so at that point, you know, his stance was, well, why should I keep rapping about this vodka brand to enrich my former partners, or at least to enrich them as much as enriching myself? And so he started looking for another liquor spirits kind of endorsement situation. You know, when the opportunity came along to do to have his financial arrangement with Armand de Brignac, you know, it seemed a lot better, the idea of being able to be seen as this tastemaker, somebody who discovered this previously unknown French champagne in a wine shop in New York, and, you know, out of the goodness of his heart to put it in his videos. You know, that was a lot more appealing to him than the sort of paid promoter kind of thing.
Well, and that's why he tried to keep his. We believe that he had an investment in the success of that champagne, but wanted to keep it right on the lowdown, partially because it's sort of uncool. And there'd been a hip hop controversy about rappers getting kickbacks from McDonald's when they would name check McDonald's and their foods and their rap songs.
Yep. Well, and what about Jeep? I know that at one point he had a deal with Jeep, and, you know, I know, Michael, you think the claim is somewhat ridiculous that he was going to receive 5% of every Jeep sold. The Jay-Z Jeep was ready to go into production, and then at the last minute, it was pulled.
That's right. You know, that 5% number, that came from a source very close to the negotiations, who's actually the guy who pitched it to Jeep and was kind of liaising with Jay-Z and Jeep. You know, so that was very real.
That's very real that he wanted that, but I can't imagine Jeep would ever agree to that. That's an insane amount of their profit margin.
This guy who was on the inside of the negotiation said that it was that's what it was. I mean, it might have been as a percentage of wholesale as opposed to retail. I have to go back and look in the book to see what I said, but at any rate, you know, 5%, that was the number that he used. So I don't know. I mean, at the time, Jeep was really hot to get into the urban market and to kind of, they're about to debut the Jeep Commander, you know, and they really wanted to make a splash and kind of, you know, give Jeep some of that, credibility, with the urban market that it once had and perhaps has again. You know, so I think they were really itching to get involved in any way they could. But then there was a change of leadership at Chrysler. And, you know, from my reporting, what I understood was that the new group was not interested in having somebody who was, you know, loud and proudly a former drug dealer involved in their brand. And they put the kibosh on the deal.
Fools. And of course, there's, you know, if we look at his life through the lens of business, we can even do that to his marriage. You know, the merger between Jay-Z and Beyonce, two of the biggest stars in the world in music. Should we just accept it as true love, or can we look at it as like everything else he does? Is there some reason to think there was any cold decision that this is providing good synergy for them rather than just being a romance?
Well, you know, it's funny because in the whole time that I started reporting the book, I never found anybody who said, oh, it's a sham, their marriage. You know, they don't actually love each other. It's just for money. You know, that said, I think that they're both very aware of the synergies that they bring to each other business-wise. You know, I mean, they've definitely, you know, they appeal to different crowds to some extent. Beyonce, of course, has more pop sound and Jay-Z more to the rap side. But, you know, both of them, I mean, Jay-Z certainly has gone a little bit more mainstream as his career has progressed, you know, but I think that he gave her a sort of street credibility that she didn't have necessarily before. She gave him this kind of wider pop appeal, and talking to media buyers and advertisers and such throughout reporting the book, you know, what they said is, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce don't ever endorse anything together, but it's kind of deliberate because when one of them does now, you know, there's sort of the tacit approval of the other one. So, you know, if Beyonce is out drinking a can of Pepsi in an advertisement, then you can kind of assume, well, you know, she's going to go home and have another Pepsi with Jay-Z. And maybe it's not a complete, you know, he's right there, you know, with her on the screen, but you know, that perception is worth something more than just, you know, just Beyonce by herself.
So to wrap up, what's the thing that surprises or impresses you the most about Jay-Z?
I think that he's always asking questions. That's something that everybody I talked to said, you know, from every stage of his career. And, you know, I went all the way back to his early days in the Marcy Projects and as recently as CEO of Atlantic Records, which put out his last album. It was Live Nation, but it was distributed by Atlantic. And, you know, they all said that Jay-Z just asks a lot of questions. He's got this thirst for knowledge, whether it be different kinds of music or different kinds of business. He's just always in there asking questions, and you know, he's not too proud, not too arrogant to act like a know-it-all. And I think that's how he's continued to add to his knowledge base and to really grow into, you know, into this 360-degree mogul that he is today.
And by 360 degrees, you mean, you know, specializes in all areas of the business.
I mean, yeah, I was being cute, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, specializes in all areas, but you know, also the 360 deal he has with Live Nation encompasses, you know, touring and recorded music and all such things. But right, that, you know, to say also that Jay-Z in a lot of ways is sort of a modern day Renaissance man. You know, kind of got his hand in a lot of things culturally, you know, as well as musically. He's got a pretty wide range of interests. Yeah.
Right. Well, now, has he responded to the book? Has he read it and called you up and told you to look over your shoulder?
No, he hasn't. But a friend of mine who works at another publication recently bumped into Jay-Z at a party, and he said, "Oh, hey, man, you know, you ought to check out this book, Empire State of Mind." And he was like, "Oh yeah, I've heard of that." So, you know, and then they got into a bit of a conversation about, you know, and Jay-Z said, "Well, he couldn't have gone too deep. He didn't talk to me." And then my friend said, "Well, you know, actually he reported this and this and this." And Jay-Z was like, "Oh wow, he did go deep." So that's kind of the most I've heard from him. It's kind of like a game of telephone, I guess, but, and take what I can get, I suppose.
Well, the book is titled Empire State of Mind: How Jay-Z Went from Street Corner to Corner Office, and it is in bookstores and on Amazon in Kindle version and all forms right now. You can pick it up. And Zach, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, as always.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot,
bye-bye. All right, take care. Bye.
And of course, Zach O'Malley Greenberg remains the world's foremost Irish Jewish expert on hip hop.
Yes, with a last name like O'Malley Greenberg, you know, who knows what his religious preference is, but I thank him for joining us and explaining a little bit more about Jay-Z. I did not know half of that about Jay-Z, did you?
Well, I did because I read the book.
Well, I meant before I read the book.
Oh, I thought you meant from the interview. No, I didn't. I knew very little about Jay-Z.
Yeah, well, I appreciate him being here, and I can speak for Michael, I believe, in saying we appreciate you listening to us every week. Again, you can subscribe to us in the iTunes store or in the Zune Marketplace or on your RSS reader. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address, or even call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find all of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've talked about on today's show and all of our past episodes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, at least for now, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. We're on Twitter. Showbizsandbox is the username to look up. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Michael Giltz has a website, michaelgiltz.com. You can find me on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.
Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to Michael. Happy birthday to me.
Does that make this now, work, you know, copyright violation?
We do owe money.
I'm taking it out of your share.